said, but the Russians did not know that. The carriage was in a siding at the Potsdamer station, and it took him only a few minutes to walk from there to the Foreign Office at 76 Wilhelmstrasse in the heart of old Berlin. His father's spacious room had a heavy mahogany desk, a painting of the Kaiser, and a glass-fronted cabinet containing his collection of ceramics, including the 18th-century creamware fruit bowl he had bought on his last trip to London. As Walter had hoped, Otto was at his desk. "There's no doubt of Lenin's beliefs," he told his father over coffee. "He says they have got rid of the symbol of oppression, the Tsar, without changing Russian society. The workers have failed to take control. The middle class still runs everything. On top of that, Lenin personally hates Kerensky for some reason. But can he overthrow the provisional government?" Walter spread his hands in a helpless gesture. "He is highly intelligent, determined, and a natural leader, and he never does anything except work. But the Bolsheviks are just another little political party among a dozen or more vying for power, and there's no way to tell who will come out on top. So all this effort may have been for nothing, unless we do something to help the Bolsheviks win, such as..." Walter took a deep breath. "Give them money." "What?" Otto was outraged. "The government of Germany to give money to socialist revolutionaries?" "I suggest 100,000 rubles initially," Walter said coolly, "preferably in gold 10-ruble pieces, if you can get them."
"The Kaiser would never agree."
"Does he have to be told? Zimmermann could approve this on his own authority."
"He would never do such a thing."
"Are you sure?" Otto stared at Walter in silence for a long time, thinking. Then he said,
"I'll ask him."
4. After 3 days on the train, the Russians left Germany. At Sassnitz, on the coast, they bought tickets for the ferry Queen Victoria to take them across the Baltic Sea to the southern tip of Sweden. Walter went with them. The crossing was rough and everyone was seasick, except Lenin, Radek, and Zinoviev, who were on deck having an angry political argument and did not seem to notice the heavy seas. They took an overnight train to Stockholm, where the socialist Borgmästare gave them a welcome breakfast. Walter checked into the Grand Hotel, hoping to find a letter from Maud waiting for him. There was nothing. He was so disappointed that he wanted to throw himself into the cold water of the bay. This had been his only chance to communicate with his wife in almost 3 years, and something had gone wrong. Had she even received his letter? Unhappy fantasies tormented him. Did she still care for him? Had she forgotten him? Was there perhaps a new man in her life? He was completely in the dark. Radek and the well-dressed Swedish socialists took Lenin, somewhat against his will, to the menswear section of the PUB department store. The hobnailed mountain boots the Russian had been wearing vanished. He got a coat with a velvet collar and a new hat. Now, Radek said, he was at least dressed like someone who could lead his people. That evening, as night fell, the Russians went to the station to board yet another train for Finland. Walter was leaving the group here, but he went with them to the station. Before the train left, he had a meeting alone with Lenin. They sat in a compartment under a dim electric light that gleamed off Lenin's bald head. Walter was tense. He had to do this just right. It would be no good to beg or plead with Lenin, he felt sure, and the man certainly could not be bullied. Only logic would persuade him. Walter had prepared a speech. "The German government is helping you to return home," he said. "You know we are not doing this out of goodwill." Lenin interrupted in fluent German. "You think it will be to the detriment of Russia?" he barked. Walter did not contradict him. "And yet you have accepted our help. For the sake of the revolution. This is the only standard of right and wrong." "I thought you would say that." Walter was carrying a heavy suitcase, and now he put it down on the floor of the railway carriage with a thump. "In the false bottom of this case, you will find 100,000 rubles in notes and coins."
"What?"
Lenin was normally imperturbable, but now he looked startled.
"What is it for?"
"For you." Lenin was offended.
"A bribe?"
he said indignantly. "Certainly not," said Walter. "We have no need to bribe you. Your aims are the same as ours. You have called for the overthrow of the provisional government and an end to the war."
"What, then?"
"For propaganda. To help you spread your message. It is the message that we too would like to broadcast. Peace between Germany and Russia.
So that you can win your capitalist imperialist war against France.
As I said before, we are not helping you out of goodwill, nor would you expect us to. It's practical politics, that's all. For the moment, your interests coincide with ours. Lenin looked as he had when Radek insisted on buying him new clothes. He hated the idea, but could not deny that it made sense. Walter said, "We'll give you a similar amount of money once a month, as long, of course, as you continue to campaign effectively for peace." There was a long silence. Walter said, "You say that the success of the revolution is the only standard of right and wrong. If that is so, you should take the money." Outside on the platform, a whistle blew. Walter stood up. "I must leave you now. Goodbye, and good luck." Lenin stared at the suitcase on the floor and did not reply. Walter left the compartment and got off the train. He turned and looked back at the window of Lenin's compartment. He half expected the window to open and the suitcase to come flying out. There was another whistle and a hoot. The carriages jerked and moved, and slowly the train steamed out of the station, with Lenin, the other Russian exiles, and the money on board. Walter took the handkerchief from the breast pocket of his coat and wiped his forehead. Despite the cold, he was sweating. 5. Walter walked from the railway station along the waterfront to the Grand Hotel. It was dark, and a cold east wind blew off the Baltic. He should have been rejoicing. He had bribed Lenin. But he felt a sense of anticlimax, and he was more depressed than he should have been over the silence from Maud. There were a dozen possible reasons why she had not sent him a letter. He should not assume the worst. But he had come dangerously close to falling for Monica, so why should Maud not do something similar? He could not help feeling she must have forgotten him. He decided he would get drunk tonight. At the front desk he was given a typewritten note. "Please call at suite 201 where someone has a message for you." He guessed it was an official from the Foreign Office. Perhaps they had changed their minds about supporting Lenin. If so, they were too late. He walked up the stairs and tapped on the room of door 201. From inside a muffled voice said in German, "Yes? Walter von Ulrich? Come in, it's open." He stepped inside and closed the door. The suite was lit by candles. "Someone has a message for me," he said, peering into the gloom. A figure rose from a chair. It was a woman and she had her back to him, but something about her made his heart skip. She turned to face him. It was Maud. His mouth fell open and he stood paralyzed. She said, "Hello, Walter." Then her self-control broke and she threw herself into his arms. The familiar smell of her filled his nostrils. He kissed her hair and stroked her back. He could not speak for fear he might cry. He crushed her body to his own, hardly able to believe that this was really her. He was really holding her and touching her. Something he had longed for so painfully for almost 3 years. She looked up at him, her eyes full of tears, and he stared at her face, drinking it in. She was the same, but different. Thinner, with the faintest of lines under her eyes, where there had been none before, yet with that familiar, piercingly intelligent gaze. She said in English, "He falls to such perusal of my face as he would draw it." He smiled. "We're not Hamlet and Ophelia, so please don't go to a nunnery. Dear God, I've missed you. And I you. I was hoping for a letter, but this. How did you manage it?" "I told the passport office I planned to interview Scandinavian politicians about votes for women. Then I met the Home Secretary at a party and had a word in his ear." "How did you get here?" "There are still passenger steamers, but it's so dangerous. Our submarines are sinking everything." "I know. I took the risk. I was desperate." She began to cry again. "Come and sit down." With his arm still around her waist, he walked her across the room to the couch. "No," she said when they were about to sit. "We waited too long before the war." She took his hand and led him through an inner door to a bedroom. Logs crackled in the fireplace. "Let's not waste any more time. Come to bed." 6. Grigori and Konstantin were part of the delegation from the Petrograd Soviet that went to the Finland station late in the evening of Monday, April 16th, to welcome Lenin home. Most of them had never seen Lenin, who had been in exile for all but a few months of the last 17 years. Grigori had been 11 years old when Lenin left. Nevertheless, he knew him by reputation, and so, it seemed, did thousands more people, who gathered at the station to greet him. Why so many? Grigori wondered. Perhaps they, like him, were dissatisfied with the provisional government, suspicious of its middle-class ministers, and angry that the war had not ended. The Finland station was in the Vyborg district, close to the textile mills and the barracks of the 1st Machine Gun Regiment. There was a crowd in the square. Grigori did not expect treachery, but he had told Isaac to bring a couple of platoons and several armored cars to stand guard just in case. There was a searchlight on the station roof, and someone was playing it over the mass of people waiting in the dark. Inside, the station was full of workers and soldiers, all carrying red flags and banners. A military band played. 20 minutes before midnight, 2 sailors' units formed up on the platform as a guard of honor. The delegation from the Soviet loitered in the grand waiting room, formerly reserved for the Tsar and the royal family, but Grigori went out onto the platform with the crowd. It was about midnight when Konstantin pointed up the line, and Grigori, following his finger, saw the distant lights of a train. A rumble of anticipation rose from those waiting. The train steamed into the station, puffing smoke, and hissed to a halt. It had the number 293 painted on its front. After a pause, a short, stocky man got off the train wearing a double-breasted wool coat and a Homburg hat. Grigori thought this could not be Lenin. Surely he would not be wearing the clothes of the boss class. A young woman stepped forward and handed him a bouquet, which he accepted with an ungracious frown. This was Lenin. Behind him was Lev Kamenev, who had been sent by the Bolshevik Central Committee to meet Lenin at the border in case of problems, though in fact Lenin had been admitted without trouble. Now Kamenev indicated with a gesture that they should go to the royal waiting room. Lenin rather rudely turned his back on Kamenev and addressed the sailors. "Comrades," he shouted, "you have been deceived. You have made a revolution, and its fruits have been stolen from you by the traitors of the provisional government." Kamenev went white. It was the policy of almost everyone on the left to support the provisional government at least temporarily. Grigori was delighted, however. He did not believe in bourgeois democracy. The parliament allowed by the Tsar in 1905 had been a trick, disempowered when the unrest came to an end and everyone went back to work. This provisional government was headed the same way. And now, at last, someone had the guts to say so. Grigori and Konstantin followed Lenin and Kamenev into the reception room. The crowd squeezed in after them until the room was crammed. The chairman of the Petrograd Soviet, the balding, rat-faced Nikolai Chikedze, stepped forward. He shook Lenin's hand and said, "In the name of the Petrograd Soviet and the revolution, we hail your arrival in Russia, but..." Grigori raised his eyebrows at Konstantin. This "but" seemed inappropriately early in a speech of welcome. Konstantin shrugged his bony shoulders. "But we believe that the main task of revolutionary democracy consists now of defending our revolution against all attacks." Chikedze paused, then said with emphasis, "whether internal or external." Konstantin murmured, "This is not a welcome. It's a warning. We believe that to accomplish this, not disunity but unity is necessary on the part of all revolutionists. We hope that, in agreement with us, you will pursue these aims." There was polite applause from some of the delegation. Lenin paused before replying. He looked at the faces around him and at the lavishly decorated ceiling. Then, in a gesture that seemed a deliberate insult, he turned his back on Chikedze and spoke to the crowd. "Comrades, soldiers, sailors and the workers," he said, pointedly excluding middle-class parliamentarians, "I salute you as the vanguard of the world proletarian army. Today, or perhaps tomorrow, all of European imperialism may collapse. The revolution you have made has opened up a new epoch. Long live the World Socialist Revolution!" They cheered. Grigori was startled. They had only just achieved a revolution in Petrograd, and the results of that were still in doubt. How could they think about a world revolution? But the idea thrilled him all the same. Lenin was right. All people should turn on the masters who had sent so many men to die in this pointless world war. Lenin marched away from the delegation and out into the square. A roar went up from the waiting crowd. Isaac's troops lifted Lenin onto the reinforced roof of an armored car. The searchlight was trained on him. He took off his hat. His voice was a monstrous bark, but his words were electric. "The provisional government has betrayed the revolution!" he shouted. They cheered. Grigory was surprised. He had not known how many people thought the way he did. "The war is the predatory imperialist war. We want no part in this shameful imperialist slaughter of men. With the overthrow of the capital, we can conclude a democratic peace." This got a bigger roar. "We do not want the lies or frauds of a bourgeois parliament. The only possible form of government is a Soviet of workers' deputies. All banks must be taken over and brought under the control of the Soviet. All private land must be confiscated, and all army officers must be elected." That was exactly what Grigory thought, and he cheered and waved along with almost everyone else in the crowd. "Long live the revolution!" The crowd went wild. Lenin clambered off the roof and got into the armored car. It drove off at a walking pace. The crowd surrounded and followed it, waving red flags. The military band joined in the procession, playing a march. Grigory said, "This is the man for me." Konstantin said, "Me too." They followed the procession. Chapter 25. May and June 1917. The Monte Carlo nightclub in Buffalo looked dreadful by daylight, but Lev Peshkov loved it just the same. The woodwork was scratched, the paint was chipped, the upholstery was stained, and there were cigarette butts all over the carpet. Yet Lev thought it was paradise. As he walked in, he kissed the hat-check girl, gave the doorman a cigar, and told the barman to be careful lifting a crate. The job of nightclub manager was ideal for him. His main responsibility was to make sure no one was stealing. As a thief himself, he knew how to do that. Otherwise, he just had to see that there was enough drink behind the bar and a decent band on stage. As well as his salary, he had free cigarettes and all the booze he could take without falling down. He always wore formal evening dress, which made him feel like a prince. Joseph Vyalov left him alone to run the place. As long as the profits were coming in, his father-in-law had no other interest in the club, except to turn up occasionally with his cronies and watch the show. Lev had only one problem. His wife. Olga had changed. For a few weeks back in the summer of 1915, she had been a sexpot, always hungry for his body. But that had been uncharacteristic, he now knew. Since they got married, everything he did displeased her. She wanted him to bathe every day and use a toothbrush and stop farting. She did not like dancing or drinking, and she asked him not to smoke. She never came to the club. They slept in separate beds. She called him low class. "I am low class," he said to her one day. "That's why I was the chauffeur." She continued, dissatisfied. So he had hired Marga. His old flame was on stage now, rehearsing a new number with the band, while two black women in headscarves wiped the tables and swept the floor. Marga wore a tight dress and red lipstick. Lev had given her a job as a dancer, having no idea whether she was good. She had turned out to be not just good, but a star. Now she was belting out a suggestive number about waiting all night for her man to come. "Though I suffer from frustrations, the anticipation's a boost to our relations when he comes." Lev knew exactly what she meant. He watched her until she was done. She came off stage and kissed his cheek. He got two bottles of beer and followed her to her dressing room. "That's a great number," he said as he went in. "Thanks." She put the bottle in her mouth and tilted it. Lev watched her red lips on the neck. She took a long drink. She caught him watching her, swallowed and grinned. "That reminds you of something?" "You bet it does." He embraced her and ran his hands over her body. After a couple of minutes she knelt down, unbuttoned his pants, and took him into her mouth. She was good at this, the best he had ever known. Either she really liked it, or she was the greatest actor in America. He closed his eyes and sighed with pleasure. The door opened and Joseph Vyalov came in.
"So it's true," he said furiously.
Two of his thugs, Ilya and Theo, followed him in. Lev was scared half to death. He hastily tried to button his pants and apologize at the same time. Marga stood up quickly and wiped her mouth.
You're in my dressing room, she protested. Vyalov said, and you're in my nightclub, but not for much longer. You're fired.
He turned to Lev.
When you're married to my daughter, you don't screw the help.
Marga said defiantly, he wasn't screwing me, Valyov. Didn't you notice that?
Valyov punched her in the mouth. She cried out and fell back, her lip bleeding.
You've been fired, he said to her. Fuck off.
She picked up her bag and left.
Valyov looked at Lev.
You asshole, he said. Haven't I done enough for you?
Lev said, I'm sorry, Pa. He was terrified of his father-in-law. Vyalov would do anything. People who displeased him might be flogged, tortured, maimed, or murdered. He had no mercy and no fear of the law. In a way, he was as powerful as the Tsar.
Don't tell me it's the first time either, said Vyalov. I've been hearing these rumors ever since I put you in charge here.
Lev said nothing. The rumors were true. There had been others, although not since Marga was hired.
I'm moving you, Vyalov said.
What do you mean?
I'm taking you out of the club. Too many goddamn girls here.
Lev's heart sank. He loved the Monte Carlo.
But what would I do? I own a foundry down by the harbor. There are no women employees. The manager got sick. He's in the hospital. You can keep an eye on it for me.
A foundry?
Lev was incredulous.
Me? You worked at the Putilov factory?
In the stables.
And in a coal mine?
Same thing.
So you know the environment. And I hate it. Did I ask what you like? Jesus Christ, I just caught you with your pants down. You're lucky not to get worse.
Lev shut up.
Go outside and get in the goddamn car, said Vyalov.
Lev left the dressing room and walked through the club, with Vyalov following. He could hardly believe he was leaving for good. The barman and the hat-check girl stared, sensing something wrong.
Vyalov said to the barman, You're in charge tonight, Ivan.
Yes, boss.
Vyalov's Packard Twin Six was waiting at the curb. A new chauffeur stood proudly beside it, a kid from Kiev. The commissionaire hurried to open the rear door for Lev.
At least I'm still riding in the back, Lev thought.
He was living like a Russian nobleman. If not better, he reminded himself for consolation. He and Olga had the nursery wing of the spacious prairie house. Rich Americans did not keep as many servants as the Russians, but their houses were cleaner and brighter than Petrograd palaces. They had modern bathrooms, ice boxes and vacuum cleaners and central heating. The food was good. Vyalov did not share the Russian aristocracy's love of champagne, but there was always whiskey on the sideboard, and Lev had six suits. Whenever he felt oppressed by his bullying father-in-law, he cast his mind back to the old days in Petrograd, the single room he shared with Grigori, the cheap vodka, the coarse black bread, and the turnip stew. He remembered thinking what a luxury it would be to ride the streetcars instead of walking everywhere. Stretching out his legs in the back of Vyalov's limousine, he looked at his silk socks and shiny black shoes and told himself to be grateful. Vyalov got in after him and they drove to the waterfront. Vyalov's foundry was a small version of the Putilov works, some dilapidated buildings with broken windows, some tall chimneys and black smoke, some drab workers with dirty faces. Lev's heart sank.
It's called the Buffalo Metalworks, but it makes only one thing, Vyalov said. Fens.
The car drove through the narrow gateway. Before the war, it was losing money. I bought it and cut the men's pay to keep it going. Lately, business has picked up. We've got a long list of orders for airplane and ship propellers and fans for armored car engines. They want a pay raise now, but I need to get back some of what I've spent before I start giving money away.
Lev was dreading working here, but his fear of Vyalov was stronger, and he did not want to fail.
He resolved that he would not be the one to give the men a raise. Vyalov showed him around the factory. Lev wished he were not wearing his tuxedo, but the place was not like the Putilov works inside. It was a lot cleaner. There were no children running around. Apart from the furnaces, everything worked by electric power. Where the Russians would get 12 men hauling on a rope to lift a locomotive boiler, here a mighty ship's propeller was raised by an electric hoist. Vyalov pointed to a bald man wearing a collar and tie under his overalls.
That's your enemy, he said. Brian Hall, secretary of the local union branch.
Lev studied Hall. The man was adjusting a heavy stamping machine, turning a nut with a long-handled wrench.
He had a pugnacious air, and when he glanced up and saw Lev and Vyalov, he gave them a challenging look, as if he might be about to ask whether they wanted to make trouble. Vyalov shouted over the noise of a nearby grinder, "Come here, Hall!" The man took his time, replacing the wrench in a toolbox and wiping his hands on a rag before approaching. Vyalov said, "This is your new boss, Lev Peshkov."
"How do?"
Hall said to Lev. Then he turned back to Vyalov.
"Peter Fisher got a nasty cut on his face from a flying shard of steel this morning. Had to be taken to the hospital."
"I'm sorry to hear that," Vyalov said. "Metalworking is a hazardous industry, but no one is forced to work here."
"It just missed his eye," Hall said indignantly. "We ought to have goggles. No one has lost an eye in my time here."
Hall became angry quickly. "Do we have to wait until someone is blinded before we get goggles?"
"How else will I know you need them?
A man who has never been robbed still puts a lock on the door of his house, but he's paying for it himself."
Hall nodded as if he had been expecting nothing better, and with an air of weary wisdom, returned to his machine.
"They're always asking for something," Vyalov said to Lev.
Lev gathered that Vyalov wanted him to be tough. Well, he knew how to do that. It was the way all factories were run in Petrograd. They left the plant and drove up Delaware Avenue. Lev guessed they were going home to dinner. It would never occur to Vyalov to ask whether that was okay with Lev. Vyalov made decisions for everyone. In the house, Lev took off his shoes, which were dirty from the foundry, and put on a pair of embroidered slippers Olga had given him for Christmas. Then he went to the baby's room. Olga's mother, Lena, was there with Daisy. Lena said,
"Look, Daisy, here's your father."
Lev's daughter was now 14 months old and just beginning to walk. She came staggering across the room toward him, smiling, then fell over and cried. He picked her up and kissed her. He had never before taken the least interest in babies or children, but Daisy had captured his heart. When she was fractious and did not want to go to bed, and no one else could soothe her, he would rock her, murmuring endearments and singing fragments of Russian folk songs, until her eyes closed, her tiny body went limp, and she fell asleep in his arms. Lena said, "She looks just like her handsome daddy." Lev thought she looked like a baby, but he did not contradict his mother-in-law. Lena adored him. She flirted with him, touched him a lot, and kissed him at every opportunity. She was in love with him, though she undoubtedly thought she was showing nothing more than normal family affection. On the other side of the room was a young Russian girl called Polina. She was the nurse, but she was not overworked. Olga and Lena spent most of their time taking care of Daisy. Now Lev handed the baby to Polina. As he did so, Polina gave him a direct look. She was a classic Russian beauty, with blonde hair and high cheekbones. Lev wondered briefly whether he could have an affair with her and get away with it. She had her own tiny bedroom. Could he sneak in without anyone noticing? It might be worth the risk. That look had shown eagerness. Olga came in, making him feel guilty.
"What a surprise," she said when she saw him. "I didn't expect you back until 3 in the morning.
"Your father has moved me," Lev said sourly. "I'm running the foundry now."
"But why? I thought you were doing well at the club."
"I don't know why," Lev lied.
"Maybe because of the draft," Olga said. President Wilson had declared war on Germany and was about to introduce conscription. The foundry will be classified as an essential war industry. Daddy wants to keep you out of the army."
Lev knew from the newspapers that conscription would be run by local draft boards.
Vyalov was sure to have at least one crony on the board who would fix anything he asked for. That was how this town worked. But Lev did not disabuse Olga. He needed a cover story that did not involve Marga, and Olga had invented one.
"Sure," he said. "I guess that must be it."
Daisy said,
"Dada."
"Clever girl," Polina said. Lena said, "I'm sure you'll make a good job of managing the foundry."
Lev gave her his best aw shucks American grin.
"Guess I'll do my best," he said.
2. Gus Dewar felt his European mission for the president had been a failure.
"Failure?" said Woodrow Wilson. "Heck no. You got the Germans to make a peace offer. It's not your fault the British and French told them to drop dead. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink."
All the same, the truth was that Gus had not succeeded in bringing the two sides together even for preliminary discussions. So he was all the more eager to succeed in the next major task Wilson gave him. "The Buffalo Metalworks has been closed by a strike," the president said. "We have ships and planes and military vehicles stuck on production lines, waiting for the propellers and fans they make. You come from Buffalo, go up there and get them back to work." On his first night back in his hometown, Gus went to dinner at the home of Chuck Dixon, one of his rivals for the affections of Olga Vyalov. Chuck and his new wife, Doris, had a Victorian mansion on Elmwood Avenue, which ran parallel to Delaware, and Chuck took the Beltline Railway every morning to work in his father's bank. Doris was a pretty girl who looked a bit like Olga, and as Gus watched the newlyweds, he wondered how much he would like this life of domesticity. He had once dreamed of waking up every morning next to Olga, but that was 2 years ago, and now that her enchantment had worn off, he thought he might prefer his bachelor apartment on 16th Street in Washington. When they sat down to their steaks and mashed potatoes, Doris said, "What happened to President Wilson's promise to keep us out of the war?" "You have to give him credit," Gus said mildly. "For 3 years he's been campaigning for peace. They just wouldn't listen."
"That doesn't mean we have to join in the fighting,"
Chuck said impatiently. "Honey, the Germans are sinking American ships."
"Then tell American ships to stay out of the war zone."
Doris looked cross, and Gus guessed they had had this argument before. No doubt her anger was fueled by the fear that Chuck would be conscripted. To Gus, these issues were too nuanced for passionate declarations of right and wrong. He said gently, "Okay, that's an alternative, and the president considered it. But it means accepting Germany's power to tell us where American ships can and can't go." Chuck said indignantly, "We can't be pushed around that way by Germany or anyone else." Doris was adamant. "If it saves lives, why not?" Gus said, "Most Americans seem to feel the way Chuck does. That doesn't make it right." "Wilson believes a president must treat public opinion the way a sailing ship treats the wind, using it but never going directly against it."
"Then why must we have conscription? That makes slaves of American men."
Chuck chipped in again. "Don't you think it's fair that we should all be equally responsible for fighting for our country?
We have a professional army. At least those men join voluntarily."
Gus said, "We have an army of 130,000 men. That's nothing in this war. We're going to need at least 1 million.
"A lot more men to die," Doris said.
Chuck said, "We're damn glad at the bank, I can tell you. We have a lot of money out on loan to American companies supplying the Allies. If the Germans win and the Brits and the Froggies can't pay their debts, we're in trouble." Doris looked thoughtful.
"I didn't know that."
Chuck patted her hand. "Don't worry about it, honey. It's not going to happen. The Allies are going to win, especially with the U.S. of A. helping out."
Gus said, "There's another reason for us to fight. When the war is over, the U.S. will be able to take part as an equal in the post-war settlement.
That may not sound very important, but Wilson's dream is to set up a League of Nations to resolve future conflicts without us killing one another." He looked at Doris. "You must be in favor of that, I guess."
"Certainly."
Chuck changed the subject. "What brings you home, Gus, apart from the desire to explain the president's decisions to us common folk?" He told them about the strike. He spoke lightly, as this was dinner party talk, but in truth he was worried. The Buffalo Metalworks was vital to the war effort, and he was not sure how to get the men back to work. Wilson had settled a national rail strike shortly before his re-election, and seemed to think that intervention in industrial disputes was a natural element of political life. Gus found it a heavy responsibility.
"You know who owns that place, don't you?" said Chuck.
Gus had checked.
"Vyalov."
"And who runs it for him?"
"No."
"His new son-in-law, Lev Peshkov."
"Oh,"
said Gus.
"I didn't know that."
3. Lev was furious about the strike. The union was trying to take advantage of his inexperience. He felt sure Brian Hall and the men had decided he was weak. He was determined to prove them wrong. He had tried being reasonable.
"Mr. V needs to make back some of the money he lost in the bad years," he had said to Hall.
"And the men need to make back some of what they lost in reduced wages," Hall had replied.
"It's not the same."
"No, it's not,"
Hall had agreed.
You're rich and they're poor. It's harder for them. The man was infuriatingly quick-witted. Lev was desperate to get back into his father-in-law's good books. It was dangerous to let a man such as Joseph Vyalov remain displeased with you for long. The trouble was that charm was Lev's only asset, and it did not work on Vyalov. However, Vyalov was being supportive about the foundry.
Sometimes you have to let them strike, he had said. It doesn't do to give in. Just stick it out. They become more reasonable when they start to get hungry.
But Lev knew how fast Vyalov could change his mind. However, Lev had a plan of his own to hasten the collapse of the strike. He was going to use the power of the press. Lev was a member of the Buffalo Yacht Club, thanks to his father-in-law, who had got him elected. Most of the town's leading businessmen belonged, including Peter Hoyle, editor of the Buffalo Advertiser. One afternoon, Lev approached Hoyle in the clubhouse at the foot of Porter Avenue. The Advertiser was a conservative newspaper that always called for stability and blamed all problems on foreigners, Negroes, and socialist troublemakers. Hoyle, an imposing figure with a black mustache, was a crony of Yalof's.
"Hello, young Peshgaf," he said.
His voice was loud and harsh, as if he was used to shouting over the noise of a printing press.
"I hear the president has sent Cam Dewey's son up here to settle your strike."
"I believe so, but I haven't heard from him yet."
"I know him. He's naive. You don't have much to worry about."
Lev agreed. He had taken a dollar from Gus Dewey in Petrograd in 1914, and last year he had taken Gus's fiancée just as easily.
"I wanted to talk to you about the strike," he said, sitting in the leather armchair opposite Hoyle.
"The Advertiser has already condemned the strikers as un-American socialists and revolutionaries," Hoyle said. "What more can we do?"
"Call them enemy agents," Lev said. "They're holding up the production of vehicles that our boys are going to need when they get to Europe. But the workers themselves are exempt from the draft."
"That's an angle,"
Hoyle frowned.
"But we don't yet know how the draft is going to work.
It's sure to exclude war industries."
"That's true.
And yet they're demanding more money. A lot of people would take less for a job that keeps them out of the army."
Hoyle took a notebook from his jacket pocket and began to write.
"Take less money for a draft-exempt job," he muttered.
"Maybe you want to ask, whose side are they on?"
"Sounds like a headline."
Lev was surprised and pleased. It had been easy. Hoyle looked up from his notebook.
"I presume Mr. V knows we're having this conversation."
Lev had not anticipated this question. He grinned to cover his confusion. If he said no, Hoyle would drop the whole thing immediately.
"Yes, of course," he lied. "In fact, it was his idea."
4. Vyalov asked Gus to meet him at the yacht club. Brian Hall proposed a conference at the Buffalo office of the union. Each wanted to meet on his own ground, where he would feel confident and in charge. So Gus took a meeting room at the Statler Hotel. Lev Peshkov had attacked the strikers as draft dodgers, and the Advertiser had put his comments on the front page, under the headline, "Whose side are they on?" When Gus saw the paper, he had been dismayed. Such aggressive talk could only escalate the dispute. But Lev's effort had backfired. This morning's papers reported a storm of protest from workers in other war industries, indignant at the suggestion that they should receive low wages on account of their privileged status, and furious at being labeled draft dodgers. Lev's clumsiness heartened Gus, but he knew that Vyalov was his real enemy, and that made him nervous. Gus brought all the papers with him to the Statler and put them out on a side table in the meeting room. In a prominent position, he placed a popular rag with the headline, "Will you join up, Lev?" Gus had asked Brian Hall to get there a quarter of an hour before Vyalov. The union leader showed up on the dot. He wore a smart suit and a grey felt hat, Gus noted. That was good tactics. It was a mistake to look inferior, even if you represented the workers. Hall was as formidable in his own way as Vyalov. Hall saw the newspapers and grinned.
"Young Lev made a mistake," he said with satisfaction. "He's fetched himself a pile of trouble."
"Manipulating the press is a dangerous game," Gus said. He got right down to business. "You're asking for a dollar a day increase."
"It's only 10 cents more than my men were getting before Vyalov bought the plant, and..."
"Never mind all that," Gus interrupted, showing more boldness than he felt.
If I can get you 50 cents, will you take it? Hall looked dubious.
I'd have to put it to the men.
No, Gus said. You have to decide now. He prayed his nervousness was not showing. Hall prevaricated.
Has Vyalov agreed to this?
I'll worry about Vyalov. 50 cents. Take it or leave it. Gus resisted an urge to wipe his forehead. Hall gave Gus a long, appraising stare. Behind the pugnacious look, there was a shrewd brain, Gus suspected. At last, Hall said,
"We'll take it. For now."
"Thank you." Gus managed not to let out his breath in a long sigh of relief. "Would you like coffee?"
"Sure."
Gus turned away, grateful to be able to hide his face, and pressed the bell for a waiter. Joseph Vyalov and Lev Peshkov walked in. Gus did not shake hands. "Sit down," he said curtly. Vyalov's eyes went to the newspapers on the side table, and a look of anger crossed his face. Gus guessed that Lev was already in trouble over those headlines. He tried not to stare at Lev. This was the chauffeur who had seduced Gus's fiancée, but that must not be allowed to cloud Gus's judgment. He would have liked to punch Lev in the face. However, if this meeting went according to plan, the result would be more humiliating to Lev than a punch, and much more satisfying to Gus. A waiter appeared, and Gus said, "Bring coffee for my guests, please, and a plate of ham sandwiches." He deliberately did not ask them what they wanted. He had seen Woodrow Wilson act like this with people he wanted to intimidate. He sat down and opened a folder. It contained a blank sheet of paper. He pretended to read it. Lev sat down and said, "So, Gus, the president has sent you up here to negotiate with us." Now Gus allowed himself to look at Lev. He stared at him for a long moment without speaking. Handsome, yes, he thought, but also untrustworthy and weak. When Lev began to look embarrassed, Gus spoke at last. "Are you out of your fucking mind?" Lev was so shocked that he actually pushed his chair back from the table as if fearing a blow.
"What the hell?" Gus made his voice harsh. "America is at war," he said. "The president is not going to negotiate with you."
He looked at Brian Hall. "Or you," he said, even though he had made a deal with Hall only 10 minutes ago. Finally, he looked at Vyalov.
"Not even with you," he said.
Vyalov looked steadily back at him. Unlike his son-in-law, he was not intimidated. However, he had lost the look of amused contempt with which he began the meeting. After a long pause, he said,
"So what are you here for?"
"I'm here to tell you what's going to happen," Gus said in the same voice, "and when I'm done, you'll accept it." Lev said, "Ha!" Vyalov said, "Shut up, Lev. Go on, Dvor."
"You're going to offer the men a raise of 50 cents a day," Gus said. He turned to Hall, "and you're going to accept his offer." Hall kept his face blank and said,
"Is that so?"
"And I want your men back at work by noon today." Vyalov said,
"And why the hell should we do what you tell us?"
"Because of the alternative, which is, the president will send an army battalion to the foundry to take it over, secure it, release all finished products to customers, and continue to run it with army engineers. After the war, he might give it back." He turned to Hall. "And your men can probably have their jobs back then, too." Gus wished he had run this past Woodrow Wilson first, but it was too late now. Lev said with amazement,
"Does he have the right to do that?"
"Under wartime legislation, yes," said Gus.
"So you say," said Vyalov skeptically.
"Challenge us in court," said Gus. "Do you think there's a judge in this country who will side with you and our country's enemies?"
He sat back and stared at them with an arrogance he did not feel. Would this work? Would they believe him? Or would they call his bluff, laugh at him, and walk out? There was a long silence. Hall's face was expressionless. Vyalov was thoughtful. Lev looked sick. At last, Vyalov turned to Hall.
"Are you willing to settle for 50 cents?
Hall just said,
"Yes."
Vyalov looked back at Gus.
"Then we accept too."
"Thank you, gentlemen." Gus closed his folder, trying to still the shaking of his hands.
"I'll tell the president."
5. Saturday was sunny and warm. Lev told Olga he was needed at the foundry. Then he drove to Marka's place. She lived in a small room in Lovejoy. They embraced, But when Lev started to unbutton her blouse, she said, "Let's go to Humboldt Park."
"I'd rather screw."
"Later. Take me to the park, and I'll show you something special when we come back. Something we haven't done before."
Lev's throat went dry.
"Why do I have to wait?
It's such a beautiful day.
What if we're seen?
There'll be a million people there."
"Even so, I suppose you're afraid of your father-in-law."
"Hell no," Lev said. "Listen, I'm the father of his grandchild. What's he going to do, shoot me?"
"Let me change my dress."
"I'll wait in the car. If I watch you undress, I might lose control."
He had a new Cadillac 3-passenger coupe. Not the swankiest car in town, but a good place to start. He sat at the wheel and lit a cigarette. He was afraid of Vyalov, of course. But all his life he had taken risks. He was not Grigori, after all. And things had worked out pretty well for him so far, he thought. Sitting in his car, wearing a summer weight blue suit, about to take a pretty girl to the park. Life was good. Before he had finished his smoke, Marga came out of the building and got into the car beside him. She was wearing a daring, sleeveless dress, and had her hair coiled over her ears in the latest fashion. He drove to Humboldt Park on the east side. They sat together on a slatted wooden park seat, enjoying the sunshine and watching the children playing in the pond. Lev could not stop touching Marga's bare arms. He loved the envious looks he got from other men. "She's the prettiest girl in the park," he thought, "and she's with me. How about that?"
"I'm sorry about your limp," he said.
Her lower lip was still swollen where Vyalov had punched her. It looked quite sexy.
"Not your fault," Marga said.
"Your father-in-law is a pig."
"That's the truth."
"The hot spot offered me a job right away. I'll start there as soon as I can sing again."
"How does it feel?"
She tried a few bars. "I run my fingers through my hair, play a little solitaire, waiting for my millionaire to come." She touched her mouth gingerly. "Still hurts," she said. He leaned toward her.
"Let me kiss it better."
She turned her face up to his and he kissed her gently, hardly touching. She said, "You can be a little firmer than that." He grinned.
"Okay. How about this?"
He kissed her again, and this time he let the tip of his tongue caress the inside of her lips. After a minute she said,
"That's okay, too."
And she giggled.
"In that case."
This time he put his tongue all the way inside her mouth. She responded eagerly. She always did. Her tongue and his met. Then she put her hand behind his head and stroked his neck. He heard someone say, "Disgusting!" He wondered whether people walking by could see his erection. Smiling at Marga, he said, "We're shocking the townspeople." He glanced up to see whether anyone was watching, and met the eyes of his wife, Olga. She was staring at him in shock, her mouth forming a silent O. Beside her stood her father, in a suit with a vest and a straw boater. He was carrying Daisy. Lev's daughter had a white bonnet to shade her face from the sun. The nurse, Paulina, was behind them. Olga said,
"Lev! What? Who is she?"
Lev felt he might have talked himself out of even this situation, if Vyalov had not been there. He got up.
"Olga, I don't know what to say."
Vyalov said harshly,
"Don't say a damn thing."
Olga began to cry. Vyalov handed Daisy to the nurse.
"Take my granddaughter to the car right away."
"Yes, Mr. Vyalov."
Vyalov grasped Olga's arm and moved her away.
"Go with Paulina, honey."
Olga put her hand over her eyes to hide her tears and followed the nurse.
"You piece of shit,"
Vyalov said to Lev. Lev clenched his fists. If Vyalov struck him, he would fight back. Vyalov was built like a bull, but he was 20 years older. Lev was taller and had learnt to fight in the slums of Petrograd. He was not going to take a beating. Vyalov read his mind.
"I'm not going to fight you," he said. "It's beyond that." Lev wanted to say, "So what are you going to do?"
He kept his mouth clamped shut. Vyalov looked at Marga.
"I should have hit you harder," he said.
Marga picked up her bag, opened it, and put her hand inside and left it there.
"If you move 1 inch toward me, so help me God, I'll shoot you in the gut, you pig-faced Russian peasant," she said.
Lev could not help admiring her nerve. Few people had the balls to threaten Joseph Vyalov. Vyalov's face darkened in anger.
but he turned away from Marga and spoke to Lev.
You know what you're going to do?
What the hell was coming now? Lev said nothing. Vyalov said,
You're going in the goddamn army.
Lev went cold.
You don't mean it. When was the last time you heard me say something I didn't mean? I'm not going in the army. How can you make me?
Either you'll volunteer, or you'll get conscripted. Marga burst out.
You can't do that!
Yes, he can, Lev said in desolation. He can fix anything in this town.
And you know what? Said Vyalov.
You might be my son-in-law, but I hope to God you get killed.
6. Chuck and Doris Dixon gave an afternoon party in their garden at the end of June. Gus went with his parents. All the men wore suits, but the women dressed in summer outfits and extravagant hats, and the crowd looked colourful. There were sandwiches and beer, lemonade and cake. A clown gave out candy and a schoolteacher in shorts organized the children to run jokey races, a sack race, an egg and spoon race, a three-legged race. Doris wanted to talk to Gus about the war again.
There are rumors of mutiny in the French army, she said.
Gus knew that the truth was worse than the rumors. There had been mutinies in 54 French divisions, and 20,000 men had deserted.
I assume that's why they've switched their tactics from offense to defense, he said neutrally.
Apparently the French officers treat their men badly. Doris relished bad news about the war because it gave support to her opposition, and the Nivelle offensive has been a disaster. The arrival of American troops will buck them up. The first Americans had boarded ships to sail to France. But so far, we have sent only a token force. I hope that means we're going to play only a small part in the fighting. No, it does not mean that. We have to recruit, train, and arm at least 1 million men. We can't do that instantly, but next year we will send them in their hundreds of thousands. Doris looked over Gus's shoulder and said,
Goodness, here comes one of our new recruits.
Gus turned and saw the Vyalov family. Joseph and Lena, with Olga, Lev, and a little girl. Lev was wearing an army uniform. He looked dashing, but his handsome face was sulky. Gus was embarrassed, but his father, wearing his public persona as senator, shook hands cordially with Joseph and said something that made him laugh. Mother spoke graciously to Lena and cooed over the baby. Gus realized his parents had anticipated this meeting and decided to act as if they had forgotten that he and Olga had once been engaged. He caught Olga's eye and nodded politely. She blushed. Lev was as brash as ever. So, Gus, is the president pleased with you for settling the strike? The others heard this question and went quiet, listening to hear Gus's answer. He's pleased with you for being reasonable, Gus said tactfully. I see you joined the army.
I volunteered, Lev said. I'm doing officer training.
How are you finding it? Suddenly Gus was aware that he and Lev had an audience around them in a ring. The Vyalovs, the Duers, and the Dixons. Since the engagement had been broken off, the two men had not been seen together in public. Everyone was curious.
I'll get accustomed to the army, Lev said. How about you?
What about me?
Are you going to volunteer? After all, you and your president got us into the war.
Gus said nothing, but he felt ashamed. Lev was right.
You can always wait and see whether you get drafted, Lev said, turning the knife. You never know. You could get lucky. Anyway, if you go back to Washington, I guess the president can get you exempted.
He laughed. Gus shook his head.
No, he said. I've been thinking about this.
You're right. I'm part of the government that's brought in the draft. I could hardly evade it. He saw his father nod as if he had anticipated this. But his mother said,
But Gus, you work for the president. What better way could there be for you to help the war effort?
Lev said, I guess it would seem kind of cowardly.
Exactly, said Gus. So I won't be going back to Washington. That part of my life is over for now.
He heard his mother say, Gus, no.
I've already spoken to General Clarence of the Buffalo Division, he said. I'm joining the National Army.
His mother began to cry.
Chapter 26. Mid-June, 1917. Ethel had never thought about women's rights until she stood in the library at Tiguen,
unmarried and pregnant, while the slimy lawyer Salman told her the facts of life. She was to spend her best years struggling to feed and care for Fitz's child, but there was no obligation upon the father to help in any way. The unfairness of it had made her want to murder Salman. Her rage had been further inflamed by looking for work in London. A job would be open to her only if no man wanted it, and then she would be offered half a man's wages or less. But her angry feminism had set as hard as concrete during years of living alongside the tough, hard-working, dirt-poor women of London's East End. Men often told a fairy tale in which there was a division of labour in families, the man going out to earn money, the woman looking after home and children. Reality was different. Most of the women Ethel knew worked 12 hours a day and looked after home and children as well. Underfed, overworked, living in hovels, and dressed in rags, they could still sing songs and laugh and love their children. In Ethel's view, one of those women had more right to vote than any 10 men. She had been arguing this for so long that she felt quite strange when votes for women became a real possibility in the middle of 1917. As a little girl, she had asked, "What will it be like in heaven?" and had never got a satisfactory answer. Parliament agreed to a debate in mid-June. "It's the result of two compromises," Ethel said excitedly to Bernie when she read the report in the Times. "The Speaker's Conference, which Asquith called to sidestep the issue, was desperate to avoid a row." Bernie was giving Lloyd his breakfast, feeding him toast dipped in sweet tea. "I assume the government is afraid that women will start chaining themselves to railings again." Ethel nodded. "And if the politicians get caught up in that kind of fuss, people will say they're not concentrating on winning the war. So the committee recommended giving the vote only to women over 30 who are householders, or the wives of householders, which means I'm too young." "That was the first compromise," said Bernie. "And the second? According to Maud, the cabinet was split. The war cabinet consisted of 4 men plus the Prime Minister, Lloyd George. Curzon is against us, obviously. Earl Curzon, the leader of the House of Lords, was proudly misogynist. He was president of the League for Opposing Woman Suffrage. So is Milner, but Henderson supports us." Arthur Henderson was the leader of the Labour Party, whose MPs supported the women, even though many Labour Party men did not. "Bonner Law is with us, though lukewarm. 2 in favour, 2 against, and Lloyd George, as usual, wanting to keep everyone happy. The compromise is that there will be a free vote." That meant the government would not order its supporters to vote one way or the other. "So that whatever happens, it won't be the government's fault. No one ever said Lloyd George was ingenuous. But he's given you a chance. A chance is all it is. We've got some campaigning work to do. I think you'll find attitudes have changed," Bernie said optimistically. "The government is desperate to get women into industry to replace all the men sent to France. So they've put out a lot of propaganda about how great women are as bus drivers and munitions workers. That makes it more difficult for people to say that women are inferior." "I hope you're right," Ethel said fervently. They had been married 4 months, and Ethel had no regrets. Bernie was clever, interesting, and kind. They believed in the same things and worked together to achieve them. Bernie would probably be the Labour candidate for Aldgate in the next general election, whenever that might be. Like so much else, it had to wait for the end of the war. Bernie would make a good member of Parliament, hard-working and intelligent. However, Ethel did not know whether Labour could win Aldgate. The current MP was a Liberal, but much had changed since the last election in 1910. Even if the clause about votes for women did not pass, the other proposals of the Speaker's Conference would give the vote to many more working-class men. Bernie was a good man. But to her shame, Ethel still occasionally thought longingly of Fitz, who was not clever, nor interesting, nor kind, and whose beliefs were opposite to hers. When she had these thoughts, she felt she was no better than the type of man that hankered after girls who danced the can-can. Such men were inflamed by stockings and petticoats and frilly knickers. She was entranced by Fitz's soft hands and clipped accent, and the clean, slightly scented smell of him. But she was Leckwith now. Everyone spoke of F and Bernie the way they said horse and cart or bread and dripping. She put Lloyd's shoes on and took him to the childminder, then walked to the office of the soldier's wife. The weather was fine and she felt hopeful. "We can change the world," she thought. "It's not easy, but it can be done."
Maud's newspaper would whip up support for the bill among working-class women and make sure all eyes were on MPs when they voted. Maud was at their pokey office already, having come in early, no doubt because of the news. She sat at an old stained table, wearing a lilac summer gown and a hat like a fore-and-aft cap, with one dramatically long feather stuck through its peak. Most of her clothes were pre-war, but she still dressed elegantly. She looked too thoroughbred for this place, like a racehorse in a farmyard. "We must bring out a special edition," she said, scribbling on a pad. "I'm writing the front page." Ethel felt a wave of excitement. This was what she liked. Action. She sat on the other side of the table and said, "I'll make sure the other pages are ready. How about a column on how readers can help?" "Yes. Come to our meeting, lobby your Member of Parliament, write a letter to a newspaper, that sort of thing. I'll draft something." She picked up a pencil and took a pad from a drawer. Maud said, "We have to mobilize women against this bill." Ethel froze, pencil in hand. "What?" she said. "Did you say against?" "Of course. The government is going to pretend to give women the vote, but still withhold it from most of us." Ethel looked across the table and saw the headline Maud had written, "Vote against this trick." "Just a minute." She did not see it as a trick. "This may not be all that we want, but it's better than nothing." Maud looked at her angrily. "It's worse than nothing. This bill only pretends to make women equal." Maud was being too theoretical. Of course it was wrong in principle to discriminate against younger women, but right now that was not important. This was about practical politics. Ethel said, "Look, sometimes a reform has to go step by step. The vote has been extended to men very gradually. Even now only about half of men can vote." Maud interrupted her imperiously. "Have you thought about who the left-out women are?" It was a fault of Maud's that she could occasionally seem high-handed. Ethel tried not to be offended. Mildly, she said, "Well, I'm one of them." Maud did not soften her tone. "The majority of female munitions workers, such an essential part of the war effort, would be too young to vote. So would most of the nurses who have risked their lives caring for wounded soldiers in France. War widows could not vote, despite the terrible sacrifice they have made, if they happen to live in furnished lodgings. Can't you see that the purpose of this bill is to turn women into a minority?" "So you want to campaign against the bill?" "Of course. That's crazy." Ethel was surprised and upset to find herself disagreeing violently with someone who had been a friend and colleague for so long. "I'm sorry. I just don't see how we can ask members of Parliament to vote against something we've been demanding for decades. This is not what we're doing." Maud's anger mounted. "We've been campaigning for equality, and this is not it. If we fall for this ruse, we'll be on the sidelines for another generation." "It's not a question of falling for a ruse," Ethel said tetchily. "I'm not being fooled. I understand the point you're making. It's not even particularly subtle. But your judgment is wrong." "Is it indeed?" Maud said stiffly, and Ethel suddenly saw her resemblance to Fitz. Brother and sister held opposing opinions with a similar obstinacy. Ethel said, "Just think of the propaganda the other side will put out. We always knew women couldn't make up their minds, they'll say. That's why they can't vote. They will make fun of us yet again." "Our propaganda must be better than theirs," Maud said airily. "We just have to explain the situation very clearly to everyone." Ethel shook her head. "You're wrong. These things are too emotional. For years we've been campaigning against the rule that women can't vote. That's the barrier. Once it's broken down, people will see further concessions as mere technicalities. It will be relatively easy to get the voting age lowered and other restrictions eased. You must see that." "No, I do not," Maud said icily. She did not like being told that she must see something. "This bill is a step backward. Anyone who supports it is a traitor." Ethel stared at Maud. She felt wounded. She said, "You can't mean that. Please don't instruct me as to what I can and cannot mean." "We've worked and campaigned together for 2 years, Ethel said, and tears came to her eyes. "Do you really believe that if I disagree with you, I must be disloyal to the cause of women's suffrage?" Maud was implacable. "I most certainly do." "Very well," said Ethel, and not knowing what else she could possibly do, she walked out.
2. Fitz caused his tailor to make him 6 new suits. All the old ones hung loosely on his thin frame and made him look old. He put on his new evening clothes, black tailcoat, white waistcoat, and wing collar with white bow tie. He looked in the cheval glass in his dressing room and thought, "That's better." He went down to the drawing room. He could manage without a cane indoors. Maud poured him a glass of Madeira. Aunt Herm said, "How do you feel?" "The doctors say the leg's getting better, but it's slow." Fitz had returned to the trenches earlier this year, but the cold and damp had proved too much for him, and he was back on the convalescent list and working in intelligence. Maud said, "I know you'd rather be over there, but we're not sorry you missed the spring fighting." Fitz nodded. The Nivelle offensive had been a failure, and the French General Nivelle had been fired. French soldiers were mutinous, defending their trenches but refusing to advance when ordered. So far, this had been another bad year for the Allies. But Maud was wrong to think Fitz would rather be on the front line. The work he was doing in Room 40 was probably even more important than the fighting in France. Many people had feared that German submarines would strangle Britain's supply lines, but Room 40 was able to find out where the U-boats were and forewarn ships. This information, combined with the tactic of sending ships in convoys escorted by destroyers, rendered the submarines much less effective. It was a triumph, albeit one that few people knew about. The danger now was Russia. The Tsar had been deposed, and anything could happen. So far the moderates had remained in control, but could that last? It was not just Bayer's family and Boy's inheritance that were in danger. If extremists took over the Russian government, they might make peace and free hundreds of thousands of German troops to fight in France. Fitz said, "At least we haven't lost Russia." "Yet," said Maud. "The Germans are hoping the Bolsheviks will triumph. Everyone knows that." As she spoke, Princess Bayer came in, wearing a low-cut dress in silver silk and a suite of diamond jewellery. Fitz and Bayer were going to a dinner party, then a ball. It was the London season. Bayer heard Maud's remark and said, "Don't underestimate the Russian royal family. There may yet be a counter-revolution. After all, what have the Russian people gained? The workers are still starving, the soldiers are still dying, and the Germans are still advancing." Grout came in with a bottle of champagne. He opened it inaudibly and poured a glass for Bayer. As always, she took one sip and set it down. Maud said, "Prince Lvov has announced that women will be able to vote in the election for the Constituent Assembly." "If it ever happens," Fitz said. "The provisional government is making a lot of announcements. But is anyone listening? As far as I can make out, every village has set up a Soviet and is running its own affairs."
"Imagine it," said Bayer. "Those superstitious, illiterate peasants pretending to govern."
"It's very dangerous," Fitz said angrily. "People have no idea how easily they could slip into anarchy and barbarism." The subject made him irate. Maud said, "How ironic it will be if Russia becomes more democratic than Great Britain." "Parliament is about to debate votes for women," Fitz said. "Only for women..."